All right, welcome back. So we're continuing with our exploration of the Four Noble Truths. So we spent the first 3 months on the first three, and now we're going into the fourth Noble Truth, which is the Eightfold Path. So Eightfold Path starts with this first path factor, which is called wise view, or sometimes called right view. I actually prefer wise view because right view gets a little bit like, what's opposite of right view is wrong view, and you know, it gets a little bit tight there. But that wiseness, I think, is a nice way of holding it. Let me talk about view just in general for a few moments, because view, I think, is something we sometimes overlook what that signifies. It's not just a concept or an idea, but actually has a fundamental way of shaping the very way we perceive ourselves, perceive the world. You can think of it as underlying premises, our understanding of how things work, that shape kind of the logic of how we engage with the world, how we show up for the world. And in that way, it governs our actions, it governs how we actually perceive things. It also sets the tone of our practice, kind of establishes the goal of our practice. And the logic and foundation from everything we practice comes from that view. And this way, we can think of this concept of view as something that's always present, whether we're aware of it or not. Every time we have some action, every time we speak, anytime we think about something, there's a view that's behind the scenes, often unknown, unconscious. And part of the practice is learning to bring that to the forefront so we can see what view is really influencing our actions. And sometimes it's hard to see what or no recognize that view, but we can kind of backtrack and see how the actions kind of reveal it. And that's part of the homework for you to practice with this week that we'll get into in a little bit. So this view, sense of view, sometimes it's wise, sometimes it's unwise, but it's always operating. It's always behind the scenes. And again, we filter everything in relationship to that view. We actually reinterpret life based upon that view, that underlying premise. And we may disregard the facts that go contrary to that. So one of the examples that I've noticed in my own practice, you know, years ago, I really got interested in this kind of inner landscape of inadequacy, of something not being sufficient, something kind of fundamentally flawed with myself. So you can see there's an overlap with the psychological work, but there's also, this is very much Dharma work also, because those kind of deeper self-beliefs form this sense of me, the sense of foundation of who I am. It also forms the view, also forms the way I interpret the world. So at one point I remember I stopped trying to fight with that pattern, but actually turned toward it with curiosity. What does this pattern actually feel like, you know, feel like as a body experience? How does it feel like mentally, emotionally? And start to notice the subtle ways that it would show up and manifest in my life, right? So turning toward it without trying to change it or fix it, but just to understand it, kind of a fundamental aspect of our practice. We often turn towards something in order to get rid of it, to fix it, to overcome it, to get more of it. But that sets up a level of tension with what we're seeing and perceiving, what we're relating to, instead of actually allowing it to be how it is. So it takes a level of trust to be able to do that, because it's such a habit to try to always change and alter. And yet, if we allow it to be how it is, we directly perceive it, and in that direct perception, it actually tends to let go of us. It's quite amazing when that happens. So back to this kind of fundamental belief that I struggled with for so many years, I started to notice, when would that show up? I felt like I was a bloodhound trying to smell the quiet scent, or the subtle scent, I should say, of that inadequacy, and start to notice wherever it would show up. And it would often be something that would come very quickly. I noticed I would hear the phone ring, and there'd be this first thought, like, oh, there's someone calling to criticize me. Or I'd open the mailbox and see that my mind put projection or rejection upon the mail that might be there. And by just observing this, I started to notice how much my whole world was filtered through this view, through this belief, through this deep assumption, So that's what I'm trying to point to, is that seeing this view that's operating is so critical in both in our psychological health, but also in our dharma. And so by seeing that more and more clearly, I started to become free of it because it wasn't running unconsciously. I shifted it from being this unconscious view to being a conscious view, which then could be examined, open to, and eventually seen through. So this is a powerful thing, this view that's operating, you know. And so the Buddha putting this as the first foundation, not the foundation, not the noble truths, but the eightfold path, the first path factor, I think is really critical because it sets up our practice for which way are we going to go. It sets up into the intention, the right aim, and then into our actions. And again, it's not always so seen or so visible, so obvious. We have to really look and perceive it because it's kind of the underlying assumptions that we're operating from. It's just how the world makes sense. It actually takes a lot of energy to be able to see through how we perceive the world to be, because it kind of makes sense to us. You know, this is how I was raised, or this is how my culture indoctrinated me, this is how my prejudice, all these things kind of made sense. But to actually see through it takes this willingness to release, to actually see how things are. And that's really what our practice is about, is learning to see clearly, to see through our distortions. And in that direct seeing, that's what transforms us. That's where insights arise. So in terms of wise view or right view and the Four Noble Truths and Eightfold Path, we can boil it down to one simple thing. You know, what causes suffering? What's the origin of that suffering? What releases that suffering? Really understanding the Four Noble Truths in a deep way. So wise view is discerning, understanding, discerning, seeing directly what leads to suffering, what leads to dukkha arising, and what leads to that cessation of dukkha, what makes that freedom possible. So a shorthand, you could say the first factor, the wise view, is actually understanding the Four Noble Truths. We've been talking about for this year so far. Where is suffering? What is the nature of dukkha? What's this nature of an impermanent experience? You know, how does that arise? What's the optional suffering? What's the suffering that's beyond our normal kind of allotment because of our physical body or emotional hearts? There's this added on suffering. And then there's the origination of that suffering, the cause of it, this tanha, this thirst. And then there's a falling away of that, the cessation of dukkha, the freedom, the Third Noble Truth. Now, even though this might be, you could see it almost as circular logic, you have to understand the first foundation or first eightfold path factor of wise view as understanding the full number of truths. It actually makes sense from this kind of three-dimensional interrelated model of the Eightfold Path. That's not just one path, do that one and then it's all done. It's that they actually build upon each other. They actually support each other. So if you're not familiar with the Eightfold Path, it has three components. The first component is the wisdom component, which includes wise view, wise intention. Then the middle component is wise action. It's how we act with our bodies, how we speak. There's a whole path factor on that. And also on livelihood. How can we have a livelihood that's not based in harm? And then the last part is the cultivation, the meditative qualities. And this includes wise effort. So how do we bring our right effort to our practice? How do we bring mindfulness to our practice? And how do we bring wise concentration to our practice? So this is the whole Eightfold Path, but sometimes helpful to see it in these three aspects. But it really comes down to, in our, to make these teachings alive for us, we have to see them not as an abstract teaching, but how they actually show up in our lives. And it's actually very exciting when you start to see that these archaic teachings from 2,600 years ago actually have a relevance in my life. actually have a relevance in how I show up in my friendships, my relationships, and my work, and just being a human being, how I relate to my mind and things that arise. You can see that the roadmap that the Buddha discovered and laid out is still really relevant for ourselves. And I think the core piece is where the First Noble Truth started with, is this is dukkha, that there is dukkha. What is the level of dukkha? How does that arise? Now, for many of us, if not all of us, this understanding of the Eightfold Path and the Four Noble Truths and Wise View in particular is an evolving process. It changes. So I've been practicing for close to 30 years, and my initial understanding of this has definitely transformed and changed as there's deeper insights, deeper understanding, as I can see more and more clearly. And so try to see these not as a static list that once you kind of got right view, you can just forget about it. It's like you have to come back and kind of refresh that. What's my understanding of this now? And now in this moment, in this year, in this day. One way to frame wise view is understanding what's unwise view and kind of this movement and this awakening from unwise view to wise view. I think when we frame it really around this concept of dukkha, of suffering, where is dukkha? Where does it arise? And what's the cessation? Now, for most of us, if we're honest, we tend to place our sense of happiness and well-being upon the conditions of our life. Right? If we have the right conditions, we have a healthy body, a young enough body, we have the right people around us, the right partner, or the absence of a particular person, then we'll be happy. You know, if we have the right possessions, or the right, you know, house and livelihood. And many of our sense of happiness is really based upon those conditions. And so then the strategy naturally flows from that. Okay, I need to orchestrate the right conditions. So the trick is that some of this is true, right? We can make our lives better. We can care for ourselves. We can develop better habits. We can be better in relationships. We can take care of things that need to be taken care of. But I'm just curious, has anyone ever figured out how not to have any of that change eventually? You know, can you get the bathwater just right and it never gets cold? You know, can you find that the perfect partner who will always, you just be totally in love, or maybe sometimes you're a little cranky with them? You know, this is the nature of impermanence. Remember the Buddha, we talked about the Buddha last week. We celebrated Vesak, the Buddha's awakening, birth, awakening, and passing, all in one day, the first full moon of the month of May. And Carrie and I led that. And I reflected on the Buddha's life and how he also went through this process of this refinement and deepening of understanding of view, of wise view. That his life was very affluent, very comfortable, you know, very princely. And why would he have any impulse to move? And that was because he realized that all those things he was placing his happiness on were actually subject to change. They were impermanent. His youth would not last forever. His health would not last forever. His life would not last forever. And seeing this, he wanted to find, where can I place my source of my happiness, really the source of my peace, outside of these conditions that are changing. So you can see the movement from unwise view, all my happiness is based on getting the conditions just right, realizing that, okay, that is subject to disappointment, to frustration, to sorrow, to suffering. Okay, that's this movement into wise view. And then seeing what can be outside of this. What can I rest my attention upon, my life upon? How can I find that sense of ease, of joy, tranquility outside of what my body is doing, what my situation is, whether my life is near its end? So practice, our insight meditation practice, as I mentioned, is just training us to be able to perceive in a clear way. Right? When we talk about feeling your breath, feeling the sensations, noticing sound, noticing thought, with a friendly attention, without trying to change or alter it, without doing anything with it, that's not just helping us be good meditators. It's helping cultivate the optimum environment for insights to arise, right? Insight meditation. We cultivate that quality of meeting things, life, experience, inward and outward, with clarity, without distortion, and from that, wisdom starts to arise. So you start to see how the Eightfold Path works together. Last factor of cultivation leads to the first part of wisdom. So starting to boil this down to what leads to suffering and what leads to freedom. How can we understand that? Now, each one of us here in the room or online listening, we have to find our own entry point, our own way of entering into the Dharma, our own gateway. And a gateway is something that kind of leads our hearts kind of alight with interest around it. We become curious of this aspect of the Dharma, of practice. It seems to speak to us and also has the potential to really transform the way we view the world and view ourselves. It starts to loosen our suffering. It starts to loosen how we are in the world. And also allows us to see directly for ourselves, you know, the truth of what the Buddha was teaching. So finding what that is alive for you, I think, is so critical. And that may change. It may change over time, over years, or even over a month. But seeing what allows my attention to alight. So to explore this a little bit more clearly, I want to use the three unwholesome roots as an entry point, as a way of kind of diving into that. Those three kaleshas, or three unwholesome roots, are of greed and hatred and delusion. So each of those three have their own way of a view showing up around them. A view kind of goes inherent with a greedy mind, with a greedy heart. There's a different view from a place of aversion or hatred. And there's a different view that comes from delusion. So let's dive into that a little bit to kind of flesh out how we can use something like that to show our view, to show how it shows up. And then from that place, shift into wise view. And again, this is not a static process, but an alive process that unfolds and evolves as our practice deepens. So let's talk about greed for a second. So greed, of course, has a lot of connotations in our culture. You know, it's a little bit like, I don't want to be labeled as a greedy person or a greedy type. And yet it's a way of, just think of it more as an orientation toward things, the sense of that wanting mind. So I have a wanting mind at times. Sometimes I go into, I hear about a sale, like REI is having a sale right now. And I've been trying to find something to want. So I got to have something to want, because it's like I'm have this hunger. And I want something to place on upon it. You know, usually, you know, before I'd be like, I would kind of forget about I wouldn't notice the wanting mind. I would just focus on the object, right? So there's some progress here. Sometimes I would go into a thrift store and just like not really wanting anything, but I hope I find something I want, something will catch my eye. So this is like that hunger, and see how a view flows from that. It's an unconscious view sometimes, but it flows and shapes my actions. Right? So learning to see that and to recognize that. Part of that process is just to look at how well that works for you, right? Has anyone, maybe I'm just haven't been successful on this. Has anyone found anything they could buy that really gave them complete lasting happiness? That was completely untarnished and always bright and shiny. So looking around at the things that we've purchased and the kind of the hope our minds placed on that. Okay, this thing, this will finally make me happy. Right? And then for somehow we forget that and we go to the next thing. So this is a fundamental force in us, is this movement of the wanting, of the greedy mind. And there's the deeper level, that there's some kind of lack that we're trying to fill. We're trying to satisfy something that's, it's like, this is kind of, I don't know quite what that is, but maybe this new toy will fulfill it. Maybe this new experience will take care of it. And so you can see as we turn toward that, that goes into a much deeper aspect, right? If I let go of the object of what I'm wanting and move into the actual experience of having a wanting mind, wanting something to fulfill that, and then what's underneath that? Some sense of inadequacy, some sense of lack, some insufficiency that I'm seeking to fill. And then if you go even deeper than that, there's that sense of you that wants to form around that, right? That's like understanding dukkha in a more experiential way. It's understanding dukkha not as this abstract thing, but this is actually, because it's unpleasant to want something. It's unpleasant to feel that sense of lack, of insufficiency. So First Noble Truth gives us this courage and inspiration to sit in the middle of our suffering, to sit in the middle of our dukkha. Not in a way to torture us, but as a way to learn from that, to learn that we don't have to keep moving from that place of pain. And so then wise view starts to come in, that, okay, this, whatever I might be wanting, it's just, maybe conditionally it's going to be helpful, bless you, but it's not something I have to really, I know more clearly what it can do, what its limitations are. So greedy mind. Then there's the hatred mind. So you may find that you kind of land on one or another. There's these kind of classic personality types that we sometimes talk about in Buddhism. I don't think it's helpful to make that as a huge defining feature of you, because that's just something else you have to let go of. But it can help you understand and navigate the way your mind is kind of wired. So hatred, I don't know if you're like me at all, but sometimes I look on the news to find something to hate. It's like there's that, okay, I just want to find, feel, you know, I don't go into details, but there's just something that, okay, I want to kind of fuel that fire, fuel that dislike, fuel that quality of aversion, right? So again, if we're not conscious to it, that view shapes the actions. Okay, scroll. Okay, what happened now? What's going on? And I can feel the emotions arise from that and the thoughts arise from that. I have conversations with my wife about it, and all those things just kind of keep spiraling. But to notice that underneath that, there's this view toward hatred, right? And from that view, if I'm looking for something to hate, I can find that, right? I can find something to hate. I can find that place of aversion. And so unwise view is just taking that and following it. Wise view is recognizing, oh, this is a pattern. This is an inclination. And maybe setting a quality of intentionality and resolve. Okay, I'm not going to hate. I'm not going to go down that path. I'm not going to close my heart to any individual, to any person, to anything, including myself. Right? It's not, doesn't mean I condone or support actions that I think are unskillful or harmful, but not closing my heart, not going to that place of hatred. Right? So that is this movement from unwise view to wise view. Right? So I can say, you know, all these things, but until you actually try it for yourself and really practice with it, that's when the practice starts to really take root in your own hearts. The nice thing about being, you know, lay practitioners, is you have lots of opportunities to do that because you're mixing it up with people. You're out there in the world. You have families and relationships and jobs, and it kind of triggers all this, right? So it triggers it, and it's a chance to practice with it. It's a chance to notice what your view is when it's leading to more suffering, and how can I cultivate a wise view? And the good news is just by noticing what's unwise, you're already moving toward wise view. It's like just feel, you're starting to feel the burn. You're feeling the hot ember. You're feeling your hand be hurt by that. You feel it metaphorically. You're feeling that pain, and that helps you not pick it up again. And then delusion. So delusion is this quality of being kind of disconnected from how things actually are. Right? Delusion is this sense of maybe being a little checked out or disconnected, not really paying attention to what's here. So the view doesn't pull in the same way or push in the same way as greed and hatred. And yet, delusion is considered the underlying one of these unwholesome roots. Because if we're confused about how things are, that's when hatred makes sense. That's where greed makes sense. Right? So that is a critical piece. That for most of us, delusion is a big thing that we're always working on. We can almost say delusion is the key one, because that's what keeps us in unwise view. That's what keeps us stuck in that unwise view, is not seeing things as they are, actually are. So starting to connect and see again, look again, connect it more deeply with something, with someone, to see through your layers of projection and your ideas. It's like that poem I like to teach around from Samuel Green that goes something like, everything I see, everything we see carries a burden of what we know until we let it be itself again. So everything we see carries this burden of what we know until we let it be itself again. And just to finish that poem, that coffee cooling in the hand, walking in the yard with coffee cooling in my hand, I see a single seed of hawksbeard balanced on a blade of grass. Except for paying attention, what else is continual prayer? So that sense of continual prayer, of course, is a different tradition, but yet we could say, what's continual meditation? Is this willingness to see and pay attention more and more deeply. So letting things, kind of letting our layers of projection, our layers of prejudice and biases and assumptions start to fall away, we can actually meet life how it is. We actually meet direct connection. We allow things to be themselves again. So that allows us to pay attention to what needs to be taken care of, what needs to be attended to in our lives and the people around us. It also reminds us to take in the beauty that's all around. That how often do we walk through a park or just past, you know, a tree and not even noticing the beauty that's there? How often do we not notice the play of the sun, the sunset or the sunrise? So taking time to take that in is coming back into this present moment, releasing the qualities of delusion, of ignorance. So a view, as I hope you kind of conveyed, is this thing that's always operating, it's always present, whether we're conscious of it or not. And learning to bring consciousness to it starts to transform us, right? Sometimes we can't see the view that's operating, but I can almost trace backwards from an action. Let's say I fire off an email that's angry, or I say something in an unkind way, or I honk the horn, or you know, flip somebody off or something like that. I can go back and say, okay, that was that action. What preceded that action? What view made that action possible? Same too with actions which of kindness, actions of generosity, actions of renunciation. Those all have a view also that's there. And then you start to connect with, and the thing that makes all this work is compassion. Is bringing compassion to how you're perceiving. Because ultimately we're talking about what causes suffering, what causes the dukkha in our lives, and also what causes the release of that, what's the cessation of that, what's the unburdening of the heart. And compassion is ultimately a compassionate process of seeing where the pain is. And so wise view is really seeing what causes suffering. And what releases that suffering? All right, let's just sit quietly for a couple moments, letting those words settle. Even as we sit quietly together, there's a subtle quality of view that's operating. The view might be one of impatience or let's get on to the next thing. and a sense of inadequacy underneath that, a sense of trying to find something more fulfilling. Or perhaps there's a simple abiding in the moment that nothing needs to be changed. All right, thank you for your kind attention. And I'm going to talk a little bit about the homework. Next week, again, we'll have the remembrance ceremony. And I forgot to mention this, but we do have some hearing assisted devices. If you have someone's having trouble hearing, it's back there by the AV table. Yeah, Adam can set you up. So the homework, and I put that in the chat for those online, is reflecting on view as this underlying assumption and framing of reality that shapes our perceptions and our actions, right? So this underlying assumptions and framing of reality that shapes our perceptions and our actions. So one way to start to play with this is when life kind of bumps up against you or you feel like there's some friction, step back and notice, what am I assuming is true? What do I think is true in this situation or in this sense of me? Is this, you know, part of, we could say, Byron Katie's work, is what is true and what is actually true. And it can trace back from actions, so including thought. You know, you get lost in a thought stream. Trace back a little bit and see, to sense what view was driving that action. You know, was it a view that was based in wise wisdom, or was it based in non-wisdom? And which leads to suffering, which leads to freedom. Right? So it's kind of a more subtle homework, better subtle way to practice. But start to play with it. You know, a simple way to do it is when you find yourself suffering, step back and kind of notice the view that's there. When you find yourself really charged and engaged, having yourself step back to notice kind of the assumptions and the view that's driving that, it starts to help the whole thing make more sense. Next time it may not arise with quite as much force. Until it doesn't arise at all. So I have some space now for any questions or sharing. So if you're here in the room, you can raise your hand. And Cheryl, you're going to bring the mic around. Thank you. And then online, you can just raise your virtual hand and I'll call on you.
Hi. Thank you for your words. And my question is about whether the root of craving or greed or wanting and the root of aversion or hatred is this more rooted view of self, that somehow like underneath those things is some unwise view about the nature of selfhood?
I think so. Yeah, I think that's kind of the underlying delusion, is that there is a sense of separation, of isolation of self. Because if there's a sense of deep interconnection, a sense of non-self, there's a sense of simply a you're perceiving from a place of non-centralized, greed doesn't really make sense anymore. You know, hatred doesn't really make sense. But from an isolated sense of self, then it makes absolute sense. I've got to get more for myself. I've got to protect it. I've got to lash out and protect, you know, through anger, through aversion. So I think it is the fundamental piece that kind of, that's the linchpin. If you look at the Four Noble Truths, you know, there's, again, different ways we've explored it. But the second noble truth is really pointing toward that tanha, that clinging, that hunger to become a sense of self. Whereas the Buddha talked about dukkha being the five clinging aggregates. This is another world map, how far we create that sense of self. And I think that's, for myself, that's a fundamental way I practice and I try to perceive things from. Because, yeah, I think you're absolutely right. If that sense of self is present and really engaged with, yeah, anger makes more sense. Hatred makes more sense. Greed makes more sense. Yeah. Another way to say it is, when you're really wanting something, you really know who you are. The sense of you is really established, right? When I'm really in that sense of hunger, I really want something, I really know who's wanting. If I'm really angry, the same thing. I am the one who's really angry. And I'm also creating another sense of self out there. Yeah, so it's very important thing to start to explore and open to. Yeah. Yes. Do you mind letting me get the mic to you? Thanks, Cheryl.
I'm going to stumble through this question.
Okay, that's fine.
We'll stumble through this question together.
Well,
it's about the process of becoming more aware.
Yes.
And whether it's a thinking process or more of a feeling process. So when I take the time and pause, that's the biggest challenge, to notice where, you know, what some pain is about. Am I thinking it through? Or am I feeling it in terms of building my awareness of it? And I was wondering if you could just talk a little bit about your process.
Sure. Yeah, so my process around it is really, I think of it more as investigation or inquiry around it. And I like to do this kind of ratio of like five, let's say four parts, use your hand for the simplicity. Four parts feeling in the body and one part thought or concept, because we are really thinking creatures, right? That's how we define ourselves and the world. And often there's these underlying beliefs that we need to be able to see and recognize and eventually see through. So part of it, the train is really is through thought. But I think if we go too much in that way, if we overly out of balance that way, it loses some of its potential. You know, it's transformational power, basically. But if you go into the body as well, and especially emphasize the body, that helps keep us connected to the present moment, helps to keep us, you know, kind of honest, and also helps kind of bring a different quality of integration to it. So, like, if I was going to do, so your question is around exploring something or that sense of opening to it. So let's say I wanted to open to something like that sense of inadequacy. So usually there's some kind of something that triggers it, right? And I think that's also a big help in our practice. It's not so much trying to be mindful like we're on retreat, like, okay, I'm reaching, lifting, you know, feeling every moment, each micro sensation. But when I feel like I get stung or hit with some emotional pain, that kind of catches my eye. Wakes me up, right? So then the trick is to kind of slow that whole process down, because usually we just kind of go into our normal habit of reaction. Blame you, blame me, you know, push away, whatever it might be. So if I can slow down and start to notice that whole landscape. So there's kind of three things I'm noticing in that moment. So I'm gonna pause in the middle of it. I might do it after the fact, right? I may the heat of the moment, I have to come back, maybe go for a walk or meditate. So I feel how my body's experiencing it. Okay, where's the actual sensation of maybe tension in the chest, that hollowness, you know, that contraction? That's one part. Another part is noticing the impulse of movement, right? So sometimes physically, there's like a physical movement. This is like some of the system is like Hakomi work with sensations and also the movement around it. But there's also the beliefs, you know, this sense of what I believe is true in this moment. So often what I do is I first start with the body that helps me connect with the body, let go of the projection or the thing I'm kind of struggling with, make it really my own experience. By doing that, I might notice, okay, there's this belief of, okay, I'm not good enough or I'm going to get in trouble. And when I feel that, then I go into the body again and feel how it is around that until that kind of balances out. And then maybe there's a deeper belief that comes and I feel that as a body experience. But I'm having this kind of skeptical idea of, that these thoughts are true. And kind of basically looking at maybe this thought is no more true than any other thought. But because I emphasize it, I place my energy into it, I form a view around it, that's when I suffer. Does that help a little bit?
That does.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah. And so that process could be, it could be a few minutes, it could be a few days or months or years, and often you just kind of start to notice. Luckily, most of us only have a few patterns, luckily, so we kind of know, we often have a core pattern that we kind of funnel everything into, and then we start to become aware of that, work with it. It starts to, over time, it starts to loosen its grip, to finally we see, you know, that it's actually just another belief. That's not just another thought that's not actually true.
I like that word, luckily.
Yes. It's actually really fortunate that we don't have like limitless supplies. It may feel like it's limitless, but if you look closely, it's like it's almost like in the middle of a spider web that's kind of going, okay, I plug that into relationships, into work, into. Okay. Thank you. All right, what else is out there? Thank you, Cheryl, the intrepid mic runner.
Hello.
Hello.
So I was thinking about right view, and one of the things that I think about when I think right view are like the 10 fetters.
Uh-huh.
And so I just wanted to know if you could like briefly touch on how those are related to right view. At least because I know that I'll probably not get to the later ones, at least in this lifetime. So at least like the first couple ones, if you could touch on those and how they're related to right view, that would be awesome.
Sure. Yeah. So the kind of the lens I was trying to look toward in this talk was just kind of what causes dukkha, what causes cessation of dukkha. So the fetters are these kind of contractions. I mean, like you can literally think of it as these things that kind of hold us constricted, hold us down. So I'm kind of giving the broader view for those who may not be familiar with the fetters. So like first stage of awakening, you know, there's three fetters that fall away. Kind of the most fundamental one is around the sense of self that we already kind of touched upon. So that sense of self, That's kind of a really powerful view. And that's what I meant by the view evolves over time. That initially we may have an understanding of white rise view that's based on trying to be kind, trying to be present, trying not to act out of a place of hatred. That's all really helpful. But eventually we see that the fundamental part of it is, is there a sense of me that's perceiving, that's acting from? So that's a key part of the view. You know, the other two in that first stage is around kind of beliefs that rituals and things like that will actually lead to my liberation. That if I just do the ritual, then I'll be free of that. And that one, I think, is probably made more sense in the time of the Buddha. That we, you know, some certainly present day, there's some traditions that do a lot of, you know, a lot of ceremony, a lot of things like that, and place, okay, if I just do that, then I will be liberated, right? So our tradition tends to look at as ritual as a support, as a way to help us maybe see things in a nonverbal way and I can, all those different aspects of it. But the ceremony itself is not enough to release. And finally, the third one is the sense of doubt in the practice, that there's, you know, I'm not quite sure. It's kind of like we're, like this stuff is really good, but, you know, some of this other stuff is, you know, I kind of attached to my wanting and my hatred, you know, and so it's like that complete conviction of the practice. So those are the first three. Now, one of the last fetters, I'll jump to the end, is the MAGA. I mean, it has two G's in it. It has two G's in it, so. But that. We call it the conceit of self, right? And that's an interesting one because that's basically, even though the sense of self is seen through, there's still this, one of the last fetters is that conceit of self. And that's when I look at someone and say, okay, we're the same, or that person is better than me, or less than me, right? So that kind of view of comparison, you know, in a more gross way is the comparison, the judging mind, I'm not doing as well, I'm doing better. And that itself creates a whole view from that. Did I get to a little bit, Charles?
Yeah.
Thank you. All right. Anyone else have anything to ask or share? Yes. We're trying to maximize how much you have to walk across the room. So over here next, and then we'll go. No.
Hi, Tim. I find all these talks every Monday really compelling, and I find myself coming out of them with large intentions to guide my actions and my thoughts and beliefs throughout the week, like especially around Right View, like bringing that into my day-to-day life. But then as I move into the week and go to work and have all my personal activities and all of that, I kind of lose sight of that and become kind of enshrouded in my own delusions and whatnot. Mm-hmm. And I was wondering if you could just kind of speak to remembering this tool of mindfulness and Right View and being able to apply that just in your day-to-day life.
Yeah, I think it's a great question. One of the first things that comes to mind is when you realize that you've forgotten it, what's your first impulse? Are you like, oh, okay, that's all right, I'll start again? Or is it a little bit like, darn, I forgot?
I think in myself, when I remember that I've forgotten it, I can be a little bit more forgiving. But then there's this, what more often happens is that I forget it and forget it entirely and then don't remember it again until we come back and meet again on Mondays.
Well, at least it's once a week you remember, right?
right.
What I would suggest is try to simplify it. You know, find one thing, because there's so many things. I mean, the Buddha was just all over lists. I mean, we could talk about the Ten Paramis. We could talk about the Four Noble Truths, the Eightfold Path, Seven Factors of Awakening, the, you know, Ten Links of Dependent Originations. There's so many things, the five aggregates. I mean, it could be just, it gets really overwhelming. There's five hindrances. I have a book that has like, you know, it has, I don't know how many pages of all the different lists and all the numbers. There's the ones and the twos and the threes and the fours and fives, and right, et cetera. So try to find what's the single most compelling thing for you. I'll ask you right now.
I think, especially recently for me, it's been trying to guide my actions from a position of not harming.
Okay, beautiful. So actions flowing from non-harm, right? So try to filter everything you hear from that lens, because you can think of it almost like a hologram that, you know, you could, I think, I don't know if I've ever actually experienced this, but I think if you had a hologram and you broke it, each piece, you could actually see the whole of it.
Mm-hmm.
But say it's like that.
Right.
So see if you can, through that lens, okay, I want to base my actions in non-harm. Right, so that becomes the lens, like, okay, View, that really fits in with that. You know, Four Noble Truths fits in well with that. And we get into the rest of the Eightfold Path, that even fits even closer. So just start to notice both when you're acting in a way that's non-harm, that's based in kindness, and also when you have that inclination toward harm. Right, so I think that's a key piece, is that sometimes we create this kind of shadow side that, okay, I want to not be a harmful person, so I push all those impulses away. But they come out in sideways places. So when you notice that you have this place of you acting in a harmful way, take time to kind of do an after action review, if you will. Kind of review what that felt like, you know, just like we talked about with inquiry. How did the body feel? What was the mind state around it? What's the payoff of that? How does it, you know, support you? So you're seeing it more clearly. And then you find that over time, that becomes, you start to make different choices. And that's really encouraging when we find in your practice, often without us even intending, that we find that usually I would have gone down this road of hatred, of harm, and I just went this other road of kindness. I just didn't even see that road, or I just didn't even pick it up. And then you can know that something's really transformed. So I would say you might journal about it, or you know, write about it, reflect at it when you go to bed. Maybe reflect, okay, where's all the times when I was actually kind today? You know, maybe not focus on all the times you weren't kind at nighttime, but notice how the times you were kind, how that felt, and how that really supported your passion of your practice. And maybe you wake up, the first thing you do is just connect with that intention. You know, so just have these touch points in the day, maybe during mealtimes. You just, okay, how can I have a place of non-harm?
Yeah, that's super helpful. Thank you.
Yeah, you're welcome. All right, so here in the middle. And remember, online, I'm happy to answer any questions from you. Just raise your virtual hand. I may not catch your physical hand. Yeah, go ahead.
Hi. So first I wanted to thank you for your comments about the thrift store. That was helpful. Okay. So recently some birds decided to make a nest in the birdhouse outside the kitchen window.
Yes.
And I was beyond thrilled. And I've been watching the birds come and go. And sadly, last week, one of the little baby birds did not survive. And then I was in touch with someone at a store, and they were advising me what to do and how to deal with that. So that was super helpful. But anyway, the last few days, the mom and dad bird were very busy bringing bugs to the birdhouse. And so it seemed like this was looking very promising. I was super excited and thrilled. My neighbors and family, they get birds all the time, and this was the first time it happened at our house. So anyway, when I was talking with the lady at the bird store, she mentioned, I was asking about, should I get some food for these birds or put out some fruit or something? And she said, the birds love bugs. That's what they're feeding the babies. And she mentioned that I could provide some worms for the birds. And it seemed like if I bought worms, even though they were finding bugs in the garden and around the neighborhood, it would be like buying a little cemetery, and all those worms would be dying because they would be so available to them. But she said the birds would be very happy to have all those mealworms. So anyway, and then today and yesterday, late in the day, I noticed the birds were not there anymore. Mm. So I've been feeling sad. But maybe they'll come back some other time and have a little family there. And what I'm wondering, though, is, does it make sense to make it easier for those birds to get bugs to feed their family, or does it not?
So just to, how should I say it, to a disclaimer, I'm not a bird expert, so there's a whole biology of that piece. So from a Dharma lens, you can look at it from, because you talked about it, there's this kind of excitement that the birds had come and they hadn't, you know, they made a nest here, all the neighbors have it. And then, okay, then a bird died and then they were back and now they're not back. And kind of there's a sense, what I would tend to point toward is just how, you know, naturally there's a part of your happiness is based on conditions. Right. If the birds are really healthy and happy, then you would be happy. And if they're not, then you're sad. And
there's something, especially with baby birds there.
It can be heartbreaking that way. And yet there's also this, okay, how can I find a sense of happiness which is outside of that, to kind of let nature have its own way? Because, you know, nature isn't always warm and fuzzy, right? There's things have to die for the worms have to die for the birds to eat, and the birds have to die for the Cooper's hawk to eat. And, you know, there's all this kind of back and forth. And see if you can, from a dharmic lens, not from what's best for the birds or not. You have to talk to the experts around that. But notice how there's that wanting quality, and how that wanting, you know, is kind of based in a view that's conditional, right? It's okay, if the conditions are right, then I'll feel the happiness. And so see if you can find a sense of happiness that's based whether the birds are there or not there. You know, whether they're well fed or not fed. Yeah.
Okay. Thank you.
You're welcome. All right, Kathy, go ahead.
Thank you, Tim. I've really appreciated this talk. And you touched on something in answer to another question that I wanted to ask you about, maybe more specifically, and it's this. This just struck a nerve right in the core of my being. Notice when I remember that I forgot my practice, what do I do? And blame myself, feel bad, hold yourself with some softness.
Yes.
I'm wondering if you could be just maybe give us some more, a little more detail, give me a little more detail anyway, on how to get from that moment of remembering that I have forgotten to the reaction to that, how I might mediate that.
Well, there's lots of ways we could explore that, but I'll use the lens of the talk tonight as a vehicle. So when we find ourselves get lost in our practice, whether we're lost in a meditation period, get lost in daydream, or just we forget to engage in our practice, and we wake up to that fact, that's a really critical moment. Because often we kind of come back with a sense of failure or judgment. I got to get myself back to on task, and I'm such a terrible meditator. I should be better now. You know, comparison. Other people must not have this trouble. It can all these different ways. But we step back a little further. We notice the view that's coming from that. Okay, the view is coming from a place of aversion, or we could say harm, or that sense of judgment. Right, so one way to play with it is how can I reestablish wise view? Okay, so and how would wise view meet this? Maybe that's another question you could hold. That would be if I had another talk, maybe I would bring that into the homework. How would wise view relate to this experience? So when we're in the middle of unwise view, it often gets confusing. It's kind of murky and muddy and by the nature kind of mixed in with a lot of diversion and a delusion and an aversion and hatred and greed. But what is wise view? How would that relate? And, you know, wise view, you know, is going to often have a quality of compassion, a quality of letting go of the past and meeting the future, meeting the moment how it actually is.
Yeah. Thank you. Thank you, Tim.
You're welcome. And I saw I made I think you made a correction to next week. So it's going to be Gisli and Sean Holmes, right? Did I say Nina? Yeah. Yeah, so it's Sean Holmes and Gisli Garcia. Nina is going to be subbing my intro class in a week. Thank you, Nina.
I have my hand up.
Oh, you have your hand up too. Okay. Go ahead.
Yes, I've been really investigating wise view in my life. And can you talk a little bit more about the factor of non-self and how we could practice or I guess investigate that aspect?
Could you give me a little bit more to go on? Because I can talk a lot about that, but just to tailor make it to how you've more about where that comes
well,
from.
Well, I have been thinking a lot about super mundane view.
Okay.
And so I see the aspect of the factors of impermanence in it and the Four Noble Truths and to understand on a higher level, it's non-self that is still, I don't know where in my.
Yeah. So hard to kind of get a purchase on that one.
Yes.
Yeah. Well, the reason one of the reasons it gets hard to find purchase on it is that it's really hard for the sense of self to see itself. If that makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
It's like you're trying to perceive. We hear about non-self and we want to try to understand it and we look for it and we seek it and try to sense it. And yet often the sense of self is kind of this background view, if you will, or it's the operating system that's actually kind of controlling the very way we're seeing it. So it's like that,
mm-hmm.
you know, those two mirrors facing each other, you know, you're trying to see yourself, but then you're seeing a reflection of yourself, which is a reflection of the reflection of the reflection, and just kind of gets endless because it's the same internal loop. So what we need to do is to break out of that or to shift out of that internal loop to basically see what can see this sense of self that's not the sense of self. All right, so this gets a little, you know, tricky and wild pretty quickly, but you're a very seasoned practitioner. So the way I would suggest is actually something is already here is the sense of kind of pure perception, the perception that's seeing, that's observing, that's very quiet and still and allowing. Okay, the sense of self takes ownership of that. I'm relating to my experience that way. All right, so using that quality to start to notice, okay, this sense of self, where am I right now? Where is that located right now in this experience? Because it's like if we don't look for it, it feels very solid. You know, especially if we're more triggered, right? Okay, I'm upset, I'm scared, I'm mad, I'm longing. But if I start to look for that sense of self, it becomes much harder to actually find that. And then you start to notice, okay, what is looking for that? What's mm-hmm. observing that? What's seeking the sense of self? And then you can start to ask, okay, then what's observing that? What's aware of that? And so you're just kind of calling yourself more and more subtly into those different qualities of perception. And really this is kind of becoming more and more refined or quieter sense of meditative witness, which is quieting the sense of self, which is very helpful. And at some point you can realize it's like things get so quiet, so still, but there's still this sense of you observing something. You know, it could be that sense of you so quiet, but there's still this sense of separation. And then you kind of hang out there and see if that sense of separation, you know, kind of inviting it to fall away.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that makes sense. Thank you.
Thank you, Nina. All right, Hannah.
Hi, thanks, Tim. So you mentioned earlier that each of us has a handful of patterns that we sort of default to. And so one of mine, which I've been investigating in my own way, is being hard on myself, which is feedback that I've gotten from a lot of people across my life and never actually thought was true until very recently.
Ah, yes.
I decided that maybe I should listen. And so what I was hearing in your talk is that I can investigate that from a body-based place, meaning one of sensation, like felt sensation, to understand what view is underlying that. But how would I translate a sensation? Say, like, I don't know if this would correspond without it being in the moment, but like tightness in your chest. That's like a very basic one. How would I translate that into a view? Like, how do you use sensation, if I understood this correctly, to investigate the view and whether or not it is wise.
Okay. Yeah, thank you for, you paid attention to all the nuances of the homework, so I appreciate all that. Trying to make it connect with that. I would kind of simplify it a little bit. And so this is what I would do is often that kind of being hard on yourself is going to be mirrored in the internal narrative, right? You know, what the story you're telling yourself. You know, I dropped something and it shatters on the floor. Okay, I'm such a klutz, you know, for example. So when I catch that, when I feel that, release the storyline a little bit, or release the object, and go into the body's experience. Okay, there's a tightness in the chest. Okay, I'm working into your question here. So you feel that tightness in the chest, and you feel that, you know, at the same time there's this narrative going on that's kind of self-criticism or harshness or not allowing or inner judgment, however you want to frame it. And so the idea is to not. Usually we just kind of go into that and just kind of hang out there in the storyline, which kind of keeps it maintained. Going to the body starts to interrupt that logic. So we're going to the body's experience of it. Now then you just be quiet with it for a while, being still with it, giving it lots of space is another, maybe a better way to say it, and giving it space to really feel it, to sense it. And by doing that, I can start to see how that becomes a basic perception of how I view myself in the world. That's what I mean by the view. It's like this underlying premise. Another way to kind of get that is, what do I believe is true right now? You know, what I like to do is hear the narrative. Okay, body sensation, feel the body sensation, hang out there. It starts to become more embodied. And then I ask, just float the question, what do I believe is true right now? What am I believing in this moment? And then let that kind of not come from me thinking about it, but just allow it to kind of emerge. It may be right away, it might be after a long time. But then that often starts to shape, show you the view that's operating, right? So the view that I'm always clumsy, or I'm never going to be better, or whatever it might be. That's kind of a superficial level of view that we can start to get a handle on. Does that kind of make a sense?
Yes. Simplifying is probably a part of the problem. So.
Yes. Think of it as having a almost a one-sided dialogue with yourself. What I mean by that is you're calling forth the capacity to just listen, to be connected, to be present, and you're letting what's often unseen reveal itself. And all you have to do is just kind of just hang out there and be still. Be quiet with it. Be open to it. Give space to it. You know, you don't have to manage, you know, if it's really charged, you know, you have to kind of find maybe a different way of approaching it. But if it's kind of like, okay, I can be with this, just be still with it. You know, relax the tendency to want to fix it or overcome it or do something with it, and just be very patient with it. Like with the bird question, if we go into the woods, all the birds are going to kind of flee from our noisy human manner. But if we just sit still for a while, even like 20 minutes, the birds start to relax and they start to come back. It's kind of a similar way of being with some of these patterns. It's like, okay, I'm going to just be still with it. So it becomes maybe just this low level of tightness. And if I'm not still, that's like when I start to act on those thoughts. I add one thought to another. Yeah, so keep it simple. Let it kind of reveal itself. Yeah, it's an easily say in a few words, but it's a process. So, yeah, feel free to reach out if you. This is one way I practice, a big part of my practice. So I'm happy to talk about it more. All right, maybe one more question if there's anyone. All right. Yeah, thank you for all the questions and sharing. That helps us really make the subject alive.